At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Lloyd Clark, Director of Research at the Center for Army Leadership at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, as well as Professorial Research Fellow in War Studies, Humanities Research Institute, University of Buckingham. We're discussing his new book about leadership, which the professor tells me is critical today in the 21st century when we're dealing with drones and robots, as it was in the 19th century with cavalry tactics and the 20th century inventing the tank. We go now to George Patton. George Patton is part of an army that does not proceed to France immediately in 1914. The bloodletting is appalling. In 1917, it is the decision of the president, Mr. Wilson, and Congress to commit the U.S. to the war. And therefore, Patton needs to find a way to the battle. He wants to fight. He wants to be a general. And he believes war will make him a general. So he appeals to Pershing to take him along in June of 17, which is a year before the U.S. really gets into the fight. Spring of 18 is when the U.S. fights. But he goes off as imagining himself as a hero. And herein, Professor, is striking. I have a note here that Patton publishes or writes up brief notes on the Army Regiment of Tanks. They're early on now. He, in 1916, 1917, the tank has been invented by the British Army. And Patton is suddenly steered into thinking about it. Is it comfortable for him? He is a horseman and a cavalryman by trade.
I think it is difficult for him as a cavalryman, but not difficult for him as a professional. He recognized that change endures and that maybe the day of the horse cavalry had passed and that the future was mechanized warfare. But he had to tread, obviously, a very careful line when peddling that sort of an argument. Certainly his family, his regimental family, would react very badly against that, even if the army more generally could see the merits in his argument. But gradually we see him play that out very, very carefully and very successfully.
Now, economy of scene, Professor, can't make this stuff up. Battle of Samahio, which is the first effort of Pershing to take the AEF into battle as a whole and not have it pulled apart. The battle bogs down, and he runs into another officer from the 42nd Rainbow. In order to get the attack moving, they both take great risks. And the other officer is Douglas MacArthur. When I read that, I thought, you're making this up, Professor.
It is a remarkable coincidence. When I first read that in some documents, I did have to do a double take just to ensure that it was the same Douglas MacArthur. And of course it was. These two remarkable 20th century future generals meeting on the same battlefield at the same time and doing the same job of leadership. Leading from the front whilst their men are hunkered down and frightened. These men are out there, the bullets zipping around their ears, trying to ensure that their men push forward and take the objective. It's absolutely within their character.
The battle that fells Patton is Ardennes. And he comes to a point where he realizes he's surrounded, his men are cut up, he's led a charge by himself into the battlefield, despite being told not to get involved as a commanding officer. He thinks time for another Patton to die, and he doesn't die. His life is saved by a man named Joe Angelo, his Batman, who believes that Patton's gone crazy. Did he? Did he go crazy at that moment? His conduct is so reckless. Do we know?
I don't think he went crazy, but I would imagine that there was this blur of activity. And whereas most of us might think, self-preservation, let's find some sort of sanctuary here, some safety. I think that Patton felt, well, this is my chance, this is my destiny. let's see what destiny brings me. The fact that he wasn't killed, he was only quite badly wounded, which itself could have led to his death, is almost, by the way, Patton would very happily have died on that battlefield. And he often refers to it later in life, when in moments of desperation and in black moods, he said, I should have died on that 1918 battlefield. That was my destiny. Where I am now is nothing compared to that.
Staffing for Bernard Montgomery, 104th Brigade. He's described as aloof, a hard worker, detailed, has talent. I'm struck by that he starts writing instructions for training of divisions for offensive action. And the big one, lessons learned in operations undertaken, a summary of the war and what went wrong. So already he's addressing his understanding of the world. And significantly, he doesn't enjoy debate. When he writes it down, it's fixed. Is that correct, Professor?
Very much the case. There was the wrong way and there was the Montgomery way. And he was very keen to ensure that his view gained the credibility that he would say that it deserved through publication. He could talk in the messes and people might call him a bore, but he was also a prolific publisher of articles and as a lecturer as well. He was always passing on his views. It is something that helped him gain confidence in his professionalism and got the name Montgomery, Burn Montgomery, out there into the wider army, and it served him well.
Erwin Rommel, again, an extremely brave man, recklessly brave, and yet I write down he was venerated, not loved, by his troops. He believes he was inspiring them with his own example. There are many times he could have been shot down and we would have never heard of him.
I think that phrase, venerated but not loved, would be equally applicable to Montgomery and Patton as well, certainly at this time in their careers. All of these men were taking extraordinary risks to themselves and demanding huge sacrifice of their men. The fact that they as leaders weren't killed is just very fortunate for them. But there were plenty of men that were dying all around them or suffered terrible wounds, or died of their wounds. And as a result of that, their men had great respect for them, particularly, I would say, for Rommel and his bravery and his professionalism. But they found him very difficult to connect with as a human being.
After the war, Patton is returned to America, and he and Eisenhower, who have become colleagues at this point, are campaigning for the tank, for new tactics, put away the cavalry. Look at the new world and battles we fought there. But it's exceedingly rejected by the high command. And they both amend their ways. Although, again, is this Patton showing his rebellious side? Because Eisenhower is a team player.
I think it is Patton showing his rebellious side. And again, it shows a man that's willing to take risks. He perceived what the future held. And it was a future of armor. It was a future of modern technology in which he could see himself playing an important part. But as we've already said, he was a cavalryman. He had grown up in the age of the horse and of the sword, and he found that very difficult to leave behind. But he certainly was a great advocate of the tank, but he had to tread very carefully for his own career prospects.
He was well-to-do, and he married Beatrice, who was also well-to-do, and they displayed their wealth when stationed near Washington by buying a house, fox hunting, yacht, polo, and at this point, Patton had behavior conduct that was remarkably out of step. He was regarded as drinking too much, a playboy, and became depressed. And that's in his letters. But we need to go to Bernard Montgomery, who, to my knowledge, was never depressed. The amazing confidence that Bernard Montgomery had as a field commander, he had early on as a brigade major. In fact, I think someone described him as having missionary zeal, which I take it wasn't meant as a compliment, but certainly describes his character. He's assigned to the Territorial Army. What was that, Professor? Why was that a significant assignment?
They weren't professional soldiers. They were what they would have called themselves at that time, weekend soldiers, reservists, if you will.
And he also meets or takes a friendship with a man who's the husband of his sister, Freddy de Guignant. I try to do the best I can with the French pronunciation, but in any event, Freddie will be critical to him until he loses him in combat in the Second War.
That's right. Freddie de Guingamp was somebody who Montgomery had picked out as a young officer of great potential. And he managed to pick him out because Montgomery, in his own time, after he had done his day's work, used to run courses for junior officers to help them pass the examinations for Staff College, which would then open up the army to them for higher rank. Freddie was one of those students. They immediately hit it off, and it was a relationship that eventually was going to serve the British Army and the country extremely well in the Second World War.
Yes, I learned from the professor that critical to all three men were the chiefs of staff, and Freddie de Guignan will become chief of staff until he falls. Rommel goes through the disruptions caused in Germany, the revolutions caused in Germany. First, he eventually joins the Weimar Republic's army, the Reichswehr, which is limited. He marries very well Lucy from the First War, and Lucy is his anchor. He does the best he can training his regiments, but these are hard times. And I go to the fact that in October of 1929, he's a lecturer at the Dresden Infantry School. Was he regarded as an inspirational lecturer? How do they remember him?
He was inspirational. This is a man that could walk the walk, as they say, as well as talk the talk. He was not somebody that had just cropped up from a staff position. This is a man that had won the highest honours for gallantry during the First World War. And he had commanded men, led men in the most exacting of circumstances. But he also had that ability to inspire men in the classroom. Very few people can do that, can translate their experiences on the battlefield and bring them to life in the classroom. But a whole generation of officers were inspired in the classroom by Erwin Rommel. And there was never a bad word said about his teaching. He was inspirational, pure and simple.
Patton, again, is admired by his peers as a war commander, but he's also a man who makes strange choices that are easily judged. The Bonus Army, 1932, Patton leads an attack on poor men, veterans who wanted some substance from the promises made to them in the First War, and they marched on Washington. It was hardly an armed camp. But Patton launches his cavalry, 3rd Cavalry Regiment, against them and is there when the Hooverville is set on fire. It's an appalling episode in American history. What I'm struck by is the note that Joe Angelo, who saved his life, Patton denies him. It reminded me very much of a character test that Patton fails again and again. He does what is convenient for him, not what is honorable.
I absolutely agree with that. We've got to remember that the chief of the army staff who was commanding this particular action, the American army against its own veterans, was Douglas MacArthur. And both of these men were using the opportunity to assert themselves in ways that I find quite remarkable, in many cases despicable. The sort of methods that were used against the Bonus Marchers were beyond what I would deem to be acceptable. And I find it incredible that that Patton could carry out those orders with such zeal. And then, of course, I think that the illustration that you've given of Joe D'Angelo being rejected by Patton, the man that had saved his life, just proves what a cad Patton could often be.
Bernard Montgomery, however, does extremely well as a teacher. And he travels widely as in the Royal Warwickshire. There's Palestine, there's Egypt, there's India. This is an empire, and we're following the British Empire with the British Army. He's a man who inspires people, but he's, again, not liked. He's not popular. He must make the test of truth, he talks about, the test of truth. Eventually, he'll be in Palestine in October of 38 as a major general. He knows war is coming. Is that correct, Professor? The army could feel it. They were ready for it.
Yes, and he was ready for it. He didn't deny that war was coming when a lot of his contemporaries felt that peace was always possible. Montgomery was always saying, that might be the case, but let's prepare for war. and he was always preparing for war. Even during long periods of peace, he said that his job as an officer and a leader was to get the army and his men ready to fight the next conflict, and nothing was allowed to get in the way of that.
I'm speaking to Professor Lloyd Clark. The book is The Commanders, The Leadership Journey of George Patton, Bernard Montgomery, and Erwin Rommel. When we come back, Rommel and Hitler. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.